So our speaker today is Jorge Pullin, and he's going to talk us about Hawking radiation in loop quantum gravity.
Okay, so this is work we have done with Rodolfo over the last year, and it's continuation, if you want, of previous work on spherical symmetry. I'm going to review a little bit the previous work, but not in an enormous detail because I've spoken about it at various meetings last year. Next slide, please. So this is the plan of the talk. As I said, we'll do a brief review of spherically symmetric vacuum quantum spacetimes and loop quantum gravity. And then we'll proceed to the new stuff, which is that we have taken a matter field, have it live on this quantum spacetime, and what we're going to do is we're going to represent the matter Hamiltonian, or the matter part of the Hamiltonian constraints, as a parameterized Dirac observable, and I'll explain what that is in some detail. We will then take the expectation value of that quantity on the physical space of states of vacuum spherically symmetric gravity, and we are left with a classical Hamiltonian for matter that is now quantum corrected, and we proceed to do a traditional sort of Fock quantization of it, finding the modes and the quantum vacua, and eventually the Hawking radiation. At the end of the talk, I'm going to end up with some speculation, so that last point is going to be a very different nature than the previous ones, on how some of these results might influence the paradigm of evaporation that people have considered for black holes and loop quantum gravity. Next slide. So to summarize the talk, we found last year in closed form the space of physical states corresponding to spherically symmetric vacuum spacetimes in loop quantum gravity. And we want to consider a test field living on the quantum spacetimes. And we will represent the matter part of the Hamiltonian as a parameterized Dirac observable for the gravitational variables. And therefore, because it's a Dirac observable on the gravitational variables, we can take its expectation value on this physical space of states of vacuum gravity. We will choose states that are very peaked around a given Schwarzschild spacetime with a given mass. One doesn't have to do that. This is just a first exploration of what's possible. So if one considers now states that are not well peaked in the mass, will have additional effects that we're not considering at the moment. The resulting expectation value of the matter part of the Hamiltonian constraint becomes a classical Hamiltonian, quantum corrected due to the quantum background space-time. We proceed to quantize that Hamiltonian in the sort of traditional Fock way, defining modes, creation annihilation operators, and obtain the vacua, and we then compute the Hawking radiation. If you want, the main take-home message of all this is boring, if you want. Nothing really unexpected happens. The main result is that the quantum background spacetime acts as a lattice discretization of the field theory, naturally regulating it and eliminating infinities, but otherwise changing very little the traditional picture of quantum field theory and curved spacetime. This was to be expected. All of this phenomenology we're discussing takes place outside the horizon, and at least if one considers black holes that are large, one expects quantum field theory and curved spacetime to be an excellent approximation to what is going on. So in a sense, the talk is boring in the sense that they're not surprising results, but on the other hand, it's very reassuring that all this can be worked out now in detail in loop quantum gravity, and it works how it's supposed to work. Next slide. So let's review briefly the sort of quantum background spacetimes corresponding to spherically symmetric loop quantum gravity. As I said, I have discussed this in several talks last year, so I think most people have heard about this. So I'll just do a brief summary. What we noticed was that if you rescale and combine the constraints of spherically symmetric loop quantum gravity, one can turn their algebra into a Lie algebra. Namely, one can find a Hamiltonian constraint that is abelian with itself and has the usual algebra with diffeomorphism constraint. As a consequence of now having the constraints form a Lie algebra, which is rather unusual, one can now perform a traditional Dirac quantization of the model. And what is more surprising is that one can find in closed form the space of physical states, the states that are annihilated by the Hamiltonian and the diffeomorphism constraint. And this was discussed in that paper that is listed there. Whoever joined, I'm in slide 4. we use the framework for spherically symmetric loop quantum gravity that was developed by Martin in collaboration with Swiderski. And in that framework, one ends up with two canonical pairs, one along the radial direction, which we call EX and KX, and one along the transverse direction, which we call EPhi and KPhi. Written on this slide are the relationships between the traditional canonical variables, GXX, G theta theta, KXX, and K theta theta, and the new canonical variables. Most notably, notice that G theta theta, which normally is R squared, is given by EX. So the eigenvalues of EX are going to correspond to the values of R squared. The kinematical states are given by one-dimensional spin networks. One-dimensional spin networks are labeled by a graph G, a tower of integers K, so that correspond to the valences of the sort of horizontal lines, of the holonomies along the horizontal lines of the spin network, a tower of real numbers mu that correspond to the point holonomies that correspond to the variable K phi. This is because KX behaves as a connection in the radial direction, whereas K phi behaves as a scalar field. Next slide. What we found was that one can actually find a basis of physical states, states that are annihilated by the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraint, that are labeled by G tilde, K, vector K, and M, where G tilde is a diffeo equivalent class of one-dimensional graphs. The Ks are proportional to the eigenvalues of the areas of symmetry, as we discussed before, are the eigenvalues of EX. And M is the value of the ADM mass, which is a Dirac observable in this case, and therefore labels the states. If you want more details on all this, again, this is for older material. We had a lengthier detailed paper with Javier Olmedo recently. The reference is listed there. So this is the space of physical states for pure gravity, the states that are annihilated by Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints. And we would like to now put a sort of quantum field living on this quantum state. For the combined system, we're going to assume that the states have the form of a direct product between gravity and the matter state. That is valid for a test field propagating on a background. More general assumption will be needed when one wants to discuss back reaction. We will represent the matter part of the Hamiltonian constraint as a parameterized Dirac observable of the gravitational degrees of freedom. Because it's a Dirac observable, one can promote it to an operator that is well-defined on the physical space of states we've been talking about. Now, some people know what I'm talking about with this, but some people might not be familiar with this technique, so I'm going to review it a bit because it has led to quite a bit of confusion when we describe this work. So next slide. So let's talk a little bit about parameterized Dirac observables in general. So I'm assuming people are more or less familiar with Carlo's evolving constants of the motion. What they are Dirac observables that are functions of a parameter. In this case, we call the parameter little t. I emphasize that's a parameter, it's not a canonical variable. Eventually, when one quantizes things, because it's a parameter, it remains classical. So qi of t, for instance, would be an example of these evolving constants of the motion. It's a Dirac observable, as the equation on the left states, it commutes with the constraints. And it has a property expressed on the equation on the right, that when the parameter takes a particular value, the value of one of the canonical variables, in this case chosen to be q1, the Dirac observable becomes one of the canonical variables. To try to make this more concrete, we can look at this little example of the relativistic particle. The constraint is the mass shell, p0 squared minus p squared minus m squared equals 0. One can define two independent, choose two independent Dirac observables written on the left. One is just simply P, that commutes with the constraint, obviously. The other one is this capital X, that one can check, that commutes with the constraints. And in terms of P and X, one can write this evolving constant of the motion Q, that is a function of a parameter and of the canonical variables, and is written on the right. And one can check that if one evaluates the parameter T at the variable Q0, one reproduces the canonical variable Q. This is well known, I think everyone has heard about this, but what is perhaps less well known is that this is also a mechanism for representing gauge-dependent quantities via Dirac observables. Notice that we now have a Dirac observable, this Q of T in the example, that is associated with one of the canonical variables, little q. Little q, of course, is not a Dirac observable, it's gauge-dependent. Yet we have been able to associate with it a Dirac observable. How could that happen? How could you associate a Dirac observable that is well-defined with a variable that is gauge-dependent? Well, the trick is that the Dirac observable really is not that well-defined in the sense that its value depends on a parameter. Its value is not well-defined until you fix that parameter. It's pretty much as the value of the variable Q, which is not well-defined unless you fix a gauge. So in that sense, choosing a parameter in this parameterized Dirac observable is equivalent to choosing a gauge. This construction can be repeated for field theories. In that case, the parameter is not just a number like T in this little example, but generically it is a functional parameter. And we can use this technique to represent quantities that are not gauge invariant in terms of Dirac observables that depend on a parameter. Next slide. So for instance, we can represent EX, the triad along the radial direction, using this technique. Again, EX obviously is not a Dirac observable. It doesn't commute either with a Hamiltonian or the diffeomorphism constraint. Yet it is clear, if you recall, that the eigenvalues of EX were associated with a tower of numbers K, that there is some invariant information present in EX, because that tower of numbers K is a bunch of integers, and if I perform diffeomorphisms on the spin network, those integers don't change. So there is some invariant information embedded in there, it's just that EX has also gauge-dependent information in it. To try to see how we can associate EX with a Dirac observable, we first construct this intermediate Dirac observable associated with a tower of numbers K, call O of Z. Z is a parameter that goes between 0 and 1 in the interval 0 and 1, and the expression is given there. It's acting on one of the states of the physical space, so it's, the state is labeled by the tower of numbers K, the graph, or the Diffie equivalence class of graphs G, and also the ADM mass, which I didn't write there just for brevity. And its action is defined on the right. It's the Planck length squared times K sub integer part of V times Z, where V is the number of vertices. Now, check what's happening as you slide with Z between 0 and 1. As you slide between 0 and 1, V times Z slides between 0 and the total number of vertices. It means it goes 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way to the total number of vertices in your spin network. That is, the eigenvalues of this operator are the tower of numbers K, K1, K2, K3, dependent on the parameter Z that you chose. Obviously then, one can rewrite the action of EX acting on these physical states as that operator O of Z of X, where Z now is a function that goes between the real line and the interval 0 to 1. As you change that functional parameter now, Z, you change the slicings that you're choosing, and that's the gauge-dependent information that is present in E of X. So we've done the sort of conjuring trick of writing E of X as a Dirac observable, but its gauge-dependent nature is present there in the fact that you have this free function, Z of X, that represents the reparameterizations of the real line. Now, if we can represent EX, we can also represent the metric in a similar way. Again, the metric is not a Dirac observable, it's gauge dependent, so it will be a Dirac observable dependent on the parameter, on a parameter. And for example, I've written there the TX component of the metric is given by the expression on the right. The parameter in this case is K phi. K phi corresponds to slicings. For instance, if you choose K phi equals to 0, GTX is 0, and that corresponds to the usual Schwarzschild slicing that is diagonal. But if you choose KX that is non-zero, you can choose other slicings, for instance, horizon-penetrating ones like Eddington-Finkelstein. It is important to emphasize that now that we have GTX, or the whole metric, if you want, as a Dirac observable, we can compute its expectation values on the space states of the physical, the space of the physical states. When one does that, we're going to put a hat on top of EX on the right. We know how to do that. I just told you previously. We're going to put a hat on top of M, the ADM mass, because it's a Dirac observable. But we're not going to put a hat on top of K phi, because K phi is similar to that little t that we had in the other example. It's a parameter. It's a functional parameter. It doesn't get quantized. It's not part of the canonical variables. It just corresponds to a choice of gauge. Next slide. So just like we wrote the metric and EX in terms of Dirac observables, we can write the matter part of the Hamiltonian in terms of Dirac observables. And the explicit expression is given here. If you squint your eyes a little bit, you'll recognize in the first line that I have just a usual Hamiltonian of a scalar field. So I have the term p squared, the term phi prime squared that now becomes discretized on the sort of spin network as we wrote it there. And then there is a p phi term that corresponds to the fact that we're in spherical symmetry. The quantities A, B, and C are all Dirac observables whose action on the states of the physical space are written below. It's well defined. In that expression, delta ki is shorthand for ki plus 1 minus ki. And k phi I that appears there, that is written calligraphic, is again a parameter. That is not, if you look at the quantum state on the right, it's not there. It's a free parameter that corresponds to the gauge freedom and the fact that the matter part of the Hamiltonian constraint is really not truly a Dirac observable, but is a gauge-dependent quantity. So we can now proceed, with these explicit expressions, to compute the expectation value of the matter part of the Hamiltonian constraint. It's very simple because you see I've written there the eigenvalues of these expressions, so it's just given by those quantities there. And in terms of those, we now have a classical quantity that corresponds to the quantum corrected equations due to the presence of the quantum background. We're now going to take that classical quantity and quantize it. Next slide. A couple of remarks here on the type of lattices that appear. The spacing on the lattice is constrained by the condition of the quantization of the area of surfaces of spherical symmetry. The fact that there is a minimum eigenvalue for the area implies that the slicing cannot be separated a distance smaller than L Planck squared divided by 4gm in the exterior of the black hole. So it imposes a minimum spacing on the lattice, the fact that areas are quantized. Notice that quantity there, L Planck squared divided by 4gm for a large black hole, is much smaller than Planck's length. So these lattices are going to be, or if you want, you can choose them to be extremely fine, okay? And as a consequence, the resulting discrete equations that we have become excellent approximation to the continuum equations for energies lower than the Planck energy, and most calculations essentially follow those of the continuum. One can proceed to define modes, and I'll sketch a little bit how you do that. It's kind of technical and boring because you're essentially reproducing the usual continuum calculations just on a lattice. So it's a little bit more complicated because you deal with difference equations instead of differential equations. But again, recall that they're excellent approximations of the continuum equations. So actually guided by them, you can actually solve them. One can build the usual Unruh, Bulwer, and Hartle-Hawking vacuum, and they resemble very much those of the continuum with very small corrections. Perhaps the most important change that one has is that certain trans-Planckian modes that would have wavelengths smaller than the lattice spacing are suppressed. Notice that not all trans-Planckian modes get suppressed because our lattice spacing can in principle be much smaller than the Planck length. But eventually you reach a point as you go more and more trans-Planckian that you find modes that are smaller than the lattice spacing and those modes are suppressed. This implies that physical quantities that might diverge at horizons, like the expectation value of the stress energy tensor, remain finite. This may have implications for future attempts to do back reaction calculations. We're in the middle of doing those calculations right now. They're not covered in this talk. Next slide. So if you take that Hamiltonian, quantum-corrected Hamiltonian that we had before that looked a little bit intimidating, the expressions there, and you compute the expectation values of it, and you work out the canonical equations of motion, at the end of the day, you discover that essentially what you have is a discretization of the Klein-Gordon equation on a given curved space-time. In terms of that, you can sort of compute the modes of the field that solve the wave equation, and do creation and annihilation operators for the mode. So for instance, for the Bulwer modes are done in terms of the tortoise coordinate that is defined there, x star j, is xj minus this logarithmic correction, that's the usual tortoise coordinate. We can choose the tortoise coordinate by choosing particular slicing in our approach that corresponds to that functional parameter z that we had, and the explicit form of the functional parameter is written on the left there. And the resulting wave equation is written down there, as you see, is a discretized version of spatially discretized version of the traditional wave equation. We have neglected the spherical potential in it because one is interested normally in computing the radiation at infinity, and there the potential vanishes. But you can include the potential if you want, just the equation gets more complicated there. And just like in the continuum, you cannot solve it in closed form. The spacing is written at the bottom. Delta J is delta plus 2gm over J. That complies with that conditional quantization of the area. And you can see that as you go to J large, close to scry, the spacing becomes delta, which is in this case Planck length. And therefore, this becomes a very good approximation for energies lower than the Planck energy. Next slide.
Can I go back to your transparency you're just showing, which began with canonical equation?
Yeah.
So you had a very nice description of the background quantum theory. And then you introduced this test field, I guess, in a couple of transparencies before this, with the Hamiltonian and so on.
Yeah.
But I'm confused about, the relation between the two. In other words, the top equation here, which says that it satisfies the equation, the wave equation on a background. So where does this background come from? How is it related to the wave function
that
you're talking about before?
Yeah, so perhaps I should have been a little bit more explicit on that. As we said, we're going to choose quantum states that are sort of approximate a semi-classical geometry well. That imposes several conditions. One of them I mentioned was, you want the ADM mass to be peaked around a definite value. But also you want some conditions on the tower of numbers k. Remember that the tower of numbers k are the eigenvalues of Ex. So you want from 1k to the next not to be huge jumps, because otherwise the geometry will jump very much. So you want, and remember Ex corresponds to r squared, so you want that to be growing monotonically as you grow out. So that imposes some conditions. Of course, there are gazillions of states that do that job for you that correspond to all the various possible sort of semi-classical geometries. But in general, with those conditions, you have associated with a state a reasonably well-defined metric approximated distributionally at the vertices of the spin network, and that is the metric that appears in this Klein-Gordon equation that we're getting.
Right. So, but I mean, just for everybody, sort of, I guess a very non-trivial result is that the states that you're talking about, the background, are actually physical states. They're
just
sort of constrained, and
yes,
they belong to the, and there are still many states which behave semi-classically. These are physical states and not kinematical states. Just for everybody. Right. And the second thing is that, I think I discussed this with Rodolfo, but I don't know how much it has happened, that all this really can be thought of as really the way it was done in quantum cosmology, by saying that you have got some background state, and the total state therefore will be a tensor product of the background state and the state of the test field that you're propagating. And you can work in the test field approximation and then show that, in fact, the field is actually propagating on some effective geometry. But I would have thought that this effective geometry would not, I mean, at least in principle, would not just be the expectation value, would not just be the mean field geometry, but rather tricky moments of this geometry come in defining the thing. So that part has not yet been done, or has it been done?
That part we have not found for these type of states we're taking. That is, to leading order, for the equations, what comes out is just the semi-classical geometry. But the rest of the construction is exactly as you described it.
Okay, thank you very much.
So let's see. So we're on the slide that says asymptotically one recovers an excellent approximation of the Bolger vacuum. The modes are written there. As you see, the modes FW and GW are what you would have written in the continuum. The only new thing is that the dispersion relation that one gets is the dispersion relation characteristic of the lattice. And it's written there with omega n. And it means that when you have sort of frequencies that approximate or get close to the lattice spacing, this dispersion relation differs significantly from the dispersion relation of the continuum. But otherwise, for modes that are much longer wavelength than the lattice, that cosine can be expanded there, and you get the usual traditional linear relationship on the lattice. By the way, NV in this slide is the number of vertices that previously I called V. Sorry for the confusion. Near the horizon, trans-Planckian modes as a consequence of that dispersion relation are heavily suppressed due to the discreteness of the spin network. And there are no arbitrary frequency trans-Planckian modes. The dispersion relation is modified in a subluminal way, that is, it does not affect the horizon structure, that is important. And there are no singularities in physical quantities like the expectation values of the stress energy tensor. Next slide. One can perform similar treatments for the Unruh and Hartle-Hawking vacua. I decided not to show them here because they get a little bit technical. The reason for that is the following. We, in our spherical treatment, we are using, from the outset, variables adapted to the symmetry that are time-independent. The spin network vertices that we have chosen are fixed in those slicings. When one goes to the Hartle-Hawking and Unruh vacuum, one uses slicings where the spin network we have chosen moves with time. And that leads to wave equations that are time dependent. So they're a little bit of annoyance to deal with, but in practice you can deal with them and you reproduce the usual results. That's the take home message. This is kind of, again, a part of boring technical part that is not terribly interesting to the wide audience, so I thought I wouldn't show it. Next slide. Finally, we proceed to the calculation of the Hawking radiation. This treatment is fairly standard. One usually computes the Bogoliubov coefficients, which are given by the inner product. Those brackets there are the usual Klein-Gordon inner product with a sort of derivative between the fields, between an out state and an in state. The only thing we do a little bit different here, and again, this is not terribly interesting, is just because we are in spherical symmetry, the modes we consider are spherical modes, not the usual planar modes. Nothing wrong with that. Planar modes can be decomposed in spherical modes and vice versa, so that really is not a fundamental problem. The modes are written there, but in the explicit calculation, that's what we use. Little u and big u are these, one is the retarded coordinate, the other one the exponentiation of it that appears in the usual Kruskal construction, and in terms of those are the written modes. And one can proceed with a usual sort of calculation of Hawking radiation, which consists on taking the number operator in the out states and evaluating its expectation value in the in states. The calculation proceeds in the usual fashion, so I'll just spare you all the details. In the traditional calculation in the continuum, one finally reaches an expression like the one written there, and that expression has a problem with at z equals zero. That's why in the continuum, one needs to sort of do a trick and put an I epsilon in it in order to make it finite. In our case, and here is the difference between our treatment and the usual continuum treatment, z has to be bigger than the Planck length, and as a consequence, that integral never goes through z equals zero, and the expression is naturally regularized. From there on, remarkably, the calculation becomes exactly the same as the calculation that had been proposed heuristically by Ivan Navarro-Salas, Holm, and Parker some time ago. They were interested in studying heuristically. They hadn't, as we did, start from first principle and derive this. They simply said, well, what happens if there is a Lorentz invariant cutoff in the calculation of the Hawking radiation? And remarkably, the expression they get is the same expression that we get from our first principle calculation. It's the expression of above, except that now it's regularized because z takes a sort of minimum value. From there on, we can just copy their final result in their paper for the Hawking radiation, and it's given by this expression here, at least for frequencies that are sort of large or naturally arising with sort of large macroscopic black holes. So the take-home message is the Hawking radiation calculation comes out as expected. Nothing terribly surprising, if you want, from the point of view of the fact that the whole physics takes place in the exterior of the black hole. What is interesting is that the cutoff that arises naturally is a Lorentz invariant cutoff in the calculation. That was a little bit unexpected. Next slide. So some future work. Of course, it is unrealistic to consider a background state that is highly peaked around the Schwarzschild mass. We just did that because it was the first pass calculation to see what came out. In general, there will be some spread that will add corrections to the equations we have and sort of leads to a fuzziness in the lattice picture. And we are studying that, and we're seeing that it leads to the emergence of non-locality in the theory. But that will have to be a future installment because we haven't done it, completed it yet. It is important to point out that in a lot of these calculations, the presence of the discrete structure that we have violates Lorentz invariance. This might improve when one considers superpositions of backgrounds in different masses. The fuzziness that I just mentioned could help with Lorentz invariance, but it might require restrictions on the type of matter fields that can be considered. This is interesting because the criticism that string theorists always had of us was that in string theory, the type of matter that you can couple is very highly constrained, whereas in loop quantum gravity, you can put any kind of matter. What we are finding now is that to have a matter content in the theory that is Lorentz invariant might limit the type of couplings that one has to introduce. But again, we're not done with that yet. Details of that will be coming out soon. The finiteness that we find in the lattice, not for the quantities we have computed up to now, which are always finite, but for things like the expectation value of the stress energy tensor, open hopes for back reaction calculations that were problematic in the continuum precisely because of that, because people had to do, renormalize and do things to take care of the divergences, whereas here all the results sort of come out finite from the outset, and this sort of opens hope that perhaps the back reaction will finally be tackled. But again, this requires more work that we're considering right now. I would like to end with some speculative remarks about evaporation. So this, from here on,
Could I ask a question about this part here?
Yeah.
Because this is very important, so I think it would be nice if we all sort of understand it. So this issue of the Lorentz invariance was confusing me a little bit, because the first few slides you had for this matter, you just put on a lattice.
Yes.
And then not only, you chose some gauge, but by choosing this, as you said, this value of k sub phi, right?
Right.
You can get one slicing
right.
or the other.
Right.
So you take some slicing. But then this choice of the lattice spacing and the slicing somehow just disappears in the final result of the Hawking calculation that you had on transparency 14 or?
Yes, because essentially the Hawking radiation takes place at scry. So there a lot of things drop out.
But how do you sort of do this? In the sense that, you only have a finite number of lattice points. And then somehow you would think that if you have to reach scry...
No, you don't. You don't literally reach scry because you can't. We're doing canonical approach, so our surface is always a Cauchy surface. But you sort of take a Cauchy surface, far away from the black hole and way into the future. As a poor person's approximation to scry. And there it's also true that a lot of things drop off.
Right. So, you said that it's not completely understood, but do you sort of roughly see, but it's difficult to explain, or is it a total miracle that all these things just disappear? Even the discreteness scale even has disappeared, right? Or has it, am I missing something?
No, the discreteness scale doesn't entirely disappear. If you look at the expression for the Hawking radiation at the end, the correction has the L Planck in there and so on and so forth, right?
Right, but the discreteness was not L Planck, right? It could have been, because it was in the lattice spacing and it was sort of encoded in this.
Yes, but if you go back to the slide where I had the Bohr vacuum, when you go asymptotically, the spacing becomes Planck scale separated.
Okay, so what can you go back to Bohr vacuum just for?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is not that one. Bohr vacuum, right? Exactly. So
the slide says asymptotically, the lattice spacing, which is variable, sort of asymptotes to a constant value, which is given by the Planck scale.
Asymptotically, lambda j goes to lambda.
Delta j, yeah.
Delta j, sorry, goes to delta. But is this something that is put in by hand, or is this how you choose your lattice, or is this something that is a result, or?
You have to choose a state that approximates well semi-classical geometry. There are many such states, and as long as they approximate a semi-classical geometry, I expect the results will be the same. On the other hand, if I choose states that don't approximate a semi-classical geometry well, then why wouldn't one expect to get similar results to quantum field theory in curved space-time?
Okay. And then finally, I mean, you've sort of emphasized very much that things like the because of this lattice, the ultraviolet issues have been kind of, there aren't any difficulties, nothing blows up.
Right.
You don't have to sort of regulate things.
Right.
But then that effect, however, does depend on lattice spacing, because near the horizon, it is not the same as near infinity, and therefore, if I had one lattice, I would get one result.
That is correct. That is perhaps you notice a change in tone between the slide where I was talking about the Hawking radiation, where things were Lorentz invariant, and the immediately one after in slide 15, where I say that the rest of the calculations still face the issue of how do we deal with Lorentz invariants, and we do have some ideas that we're working on right now, but at the moment I don't have a definitive answer for that.
Okay. So the statement is that as far as calculations of scattering are concerned, so if you just do measurements at infinity or very far from the black hole, then you seem to be okay with Lorentz invariance.
Right, but inside, so to speak, everything because of the presence of the lattice is manifestly violating Lorentz invariance, so something else needs to be done there. And we believe that a combination of this sort of fuzziness emergent from considering superpositions of different ADM masses, coupled with restrictions on the type of matter content you can put, probably can lead to Lorentz invariance. But again, that's something we're working on right now.
Thank you very much.
So we're in slide 16, and I was saying that the nature of the talk now changes. The previous part of the talk was sort of boring, lots of calculations that led to results that were expected. Here we're going to enter a much more speculative ground, and we're doing this because every time we gave talks about this, people came to us with questions. They said, well, what about firewalls? Well, how do these things of yours change things? And of course, none of that can be answered until we can do back reaction, okay? So all this is speculation. So we were asking ourselves, how would the paradigm for black hole evaporation that Martin and Abai introduced get changed by some of the findings that we are encountering in these calculations we have? One of them is associated with this construction that a lot of people do of the nice slices to compute this Hawking radiation. What they do is they compute slices that inside the black hole asymptotes to the singularity and outside the black hole asymptotes to Cauchy surfaces. As you go from one slide to and they impose several sort of conditions on those slices, namely that they intrinsic and extrinsic curvature be much lower than Planck curvature and so on and so forth. And what people find is that by going from one slice to the next, because of the deformation of the slice, they can compute the Hawking radiation. The interesting point that we encounter is that because of the quantization of the area, there is only a finite number of nice slices that you can fit into the black hole, because at some point the spacing between a slicing and the next gets constrained by the quantization of the area, and eventually you reach the point where the singularity would have been, that is, isn't there anymore, and eventually your slice is outside of the black hole on the other side, so to speak. So that implies that from the point of view of an observer in the exterior, these nice slices that were used for computing the Hawking radiation stop at some point where the slice would have sort of touched where the singularity used to be. That means that the Hawking evaporation stops at a given point. In fact, if we go to the next slide, you can sort of do an order of magnitude calculation to see what the number of slicing is, and it's given by that calculation there, integer part 2gm squared over L Planck squared, and that means that for an external observer, the nice slices sort of end at that time, given by that expression there, that is approximate of the order of magnitude of evaporation time, but it means that the Hawking radiation at some point stops. In fact, we're not the first to make that argument. Nima Arkani Hamed and other people had proposed a similar mechanism with a different motivation. In their case, the slices didn't stop because of the quantization of area, like in our case. They claimed that the slices sort of stopped because they became so close to each other that there was no clock that could discriminate them, sort of invoking real clocks. Our argument is different. The slices just cannot be fit because there's a minimum quantization of the area. And so the picture that emerges from either of those approaches is given at the bottom, and it's close to the picture that was first envisioned by Hawking. Namely, you have a sort of horizon trying to form. Particle production takes place around that horizon. One of the particles falls in, one goes out, as those two little arrows at the bottom represent. But eventually, a white hole forms, and the particles that fell into the black hole can get out, and the Hawking radiation stops. And so this could provide an information solution to the information paradox without invoking firewalls. And as you see, it has elements in common with the Planck stars of Francesca and Carlo, but the mechanism we're invoking is different. It's closer to this mechanism that Arkami Hamed et al. Had sort of brought about. Next slide. So let me conclude here. So the message is we can formulate quantum field theory in quantum spacetime for fields on spherically symmetric backgrounds. In fact, we have assumed the fields are spherically symmetric themselves, but you don't need to do that because what you can do is you can decompose the field in modes, in angular modes, and then the equations for each mode, they're all the same equation with slightly different parameters. They're all the Zorelli equation with different values of L and M. And so the same treatment that we did for the zero mode here can be extended to the other modes. So in fact, the test fields don't really need to be spherically symmetric. The take-home message is that quantum field theory in curved space-time is approximated very well. The discreteness naturally regularizes physical quantities, opening the possibility of back reaction calculations. Hawking radiation can be computed, and the result coincides with previous heuristic results. So it's nice to make contact with what people were expecting was going to come out. And that a new paradigm for black hole evaporation emerges, incorporating elements from the quantum background into the paradigm that we had before from Martin and I. In particular, this idea that the certain I slices are a finite number that finish at some point, and therefore the Hawking evaporation cuts off when the black hole is sort of still large. Okay, thank you very much.
Questions?
I have a small question. Earlier on in the talk, you mentioned that you had a minimal distance between vertices because you had the quantization of area.
Correct.
I wasn't quite sure where this was coming from, because you're not in Euclidean flat geometry, so I don't know if you're using some other Hamiltonian constraints or something. I don't know what.
No, these are the areas of spherical symmetry, so they're just given by R squared. So it is a well-defined quantity, and the idea is that when you go from a radial value to another radial value, the sort of difference between the values of the area is given by the quantization of the area that we get in full 3D, of course. So we're motivating that from the known quantization of the area in 3D.
So you're just using the areal radius.
Sorry?
Yes. So you're talking about the aerial, the difference of aerial radii. You're not talking about actual distances between the spherically symmetric surfaces.
Right. So, but the values of those aerial radii are given sort of by the positions of the points of the spin network. In any coordinate you like. Value will be coordinate dependent, but... For the values of the areas of symmetry, which is a well-defined quantity, that is a given number. You can translate it to any coordinate you want, then.
Okay. Got it.
Would I go back to your last part of the talk? So transparency 16, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'd like to understand a little bit more detail here. So I think what you're saying is that usually people had this slicing, the right-hand picture that you have.
Yes.
So you had this slice. People continued this slicing all the way until you sort of reached arbitrary close to singularity.
Right.
And you're saying that because of this area quantization, this description just fails. This kind of slicing that one can draw.
Right.
But to me, that conclusion, therefore, is not that there is no physics there or Hawking radiation stopped. I mean, I don't know. Depends on the technical meaning of Hawking radiation now. So the statement is that the calculation that people used in order to calculate what is the outflux, the standard calculation, that would stop. That just limits, right? I mean, in the sense that calculation cannot be continued because you don't have any more slicing.
No, but you can continue the slicing in our case because the singularity is not there anymore. It's just that when you go on the other side of the singularity, you're reversing the original process. The slices become sort of flatter and flatter, so to speak. I mean, think of your paradigm. In your paradigm, you would definitely, of course, there'll be a region there in the middle where we don't know exactly what's going on because it's not well approximated by a quantum geometry, by a semi-classical geometry. But you could continue the slices up all the way to scribe plus. So there will become sort of now Cauchy slices on top, and because it become Cauchy slices, there's no more Hawking radiation. The only radiation coming out is the radiation that went in originally. That's why we speak about a white hole.
I mean, what one has to do is really, there's some quantum state of both geometry and matter in that shaded region, if you like.
Yes.
And what comes out is really the evolution of this quantum state, right?
Yes.
Which will require a more careful analysis.
Yes.
You cannot do this. It is, so in other words, at this stage, it's sort of going beyond, you can talk about Hawking radiation by the time you enter the shaded region. But once you are in the shaded region or even to the future of it, it's not really possible to calculate until you have a better theory, right? Because
correct.
I mean, you cannot just say that there is no Hawking radiation because, I mean, the word Hawking radiation is a bit misleading, right? So, because physically what one wants is really what is the evolution of that particular state that went in? And that state went in into the shaded region and then came out again.
Yeah, so all that stuff will come out in a way that we cannot predict. The main point we're making is, however, that the slices continue into the top, and when you're in the top, there's no black hole, there's nothing there anymore, so there's no reason why associated with slicing you're going to get any Hawking radiation. There'll be all the other stuff that you were talking about coming out, but no radiation associated with slicing.
Right. There's no radiation associated with slicing, so I think just the word Hawking radiation is used in so many different ways, senses, right? So one can just say that there is no radiation associated with slices.
Right.
There is still radiation.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everything that fell in will come out now. There's nothing preventing it from coming out.
Right, but it's sort of, it's not that it's going to come out in this. If you put
no.
it in a way that everything that fell in came out, it looks like it is just, nothing is happening. It's just coming
oh,
out.
Oh, no. Through a very complex process that we can't compute. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, sorry. That was sort of implicit in what I was saying.
Right. But I think for other people, it might not be.
Okay.
So because if there is like Hawking radiation stops, then people would immediately say, oh, that means that there is a huge remnant. Right? I mean, that's.
No, that's not what we're implying at all, no. That's why we're speaking about a white hole, if you want, that all this stuff ends up coming out through a very complicated intermediate process.
Right. But I think this is not what Hawking was saying, right? I mean, Hawking was saying something, maybe I misunderstood, but. In the next transparency, when you say that this is reminiscent of what Hawking is saying.
Yeah.
Because there, I mean, he sort of, the fact that the horizon never forms is something that we know from very detailed calculation in the sense that there is no event horizon, but there are marginally trapped surfaces. And then the area of that marginally trapped surfaces goes to zero, right? I mean, and I think that is not, so that's what kind of the detailed calculations are shown, whereas Hawking, are you saying that the area of the marginal trapped surfaces does not go to zero?
Maybe. Oh, no. I was just saying that Hawking was saying that through there's very little difference between a white hole and a black hole in the sense that both radiate, and in this picture that is emerging. Through the future of this, it's radiating, as you said, through a very complicated process, and to the past of it, it was radiating through traditional Hawking radiation. But of course, it's conjectural to say that these two things are the same. They could be different.
Right. But I think there is a common element between Arkanyi Hammad and you. And namely, one is saying that semi-classical description is basically failing in that shaded region.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're saying that you cannot use this geometrical meaning because the physical clocks don't make sense or something. But these are kind of the traditional clocks which make sense in a given space-time. And then the space-time geometry is becoming is not a good description. And you are also saying that, well, you have some quantum geometry, but in that region, I think you are saying that in that region, this effective geometry does not necessarily make sense. The mean geometry that you can calculate, that doesn't make sense. Because is that right, or are you saying that there is actually a well-defined mean geometry?
Unfortunately, we don't know, because from the point of view of our solutions, you can have both. You can have a well-defined geometry with high curvature in there, or you can have something that doesn't have a well-defined geometry. Unfortunately, the model is too limited to tell you which one happens in nature.
Okay, so, but you have got this well-defined geometry with very high curvature. Let's take that for a minute.
Yeah.
And then this is the statement that somehow, however, this geometry is going to sort of, as you go in the future, it becomes flatter and flatter. So you are going to say that this well-defined geometry
my hunch is that is not what happens in nature, but it's allowed by the model. Yeah.
Right, but in the model. So, but still, this. I mean, it's going to lose its curvature gradually, right? I mean, it's not,
right.
There's no sudden process.
No.
So there'll be some if there is a well-defined geometry, then there's some effective equations that you will have.
Yes.
That are correcting Einstein's equation because you don't have singularity.
Yes.
So there's some effective equations that you have, which are going to give you this well-defined geometry, and then it sort of gradually becomes flat.
Yeah.
From this point of view also, even if there was no quantum region, there is a large region in which the geometry is not flat. You see, what I'm trying to say is, if I were to draw the distinction between, on slide 16, between the two pictures there, right?
Yeah.
Then people usually say that on the right-hand picture, in the triangle that you have to the future of the dotted line, geometry is just flat here. And I think if you take your well-defined geometry, it's not going to be,
absolutely.
I think that geometry is just flat there because they say that, the mass is essentially zero here.
Right. No, that's not the case.
That's not the case. Okay.
Right.
So
you said it will be gradual.
Sorry, what did you say?
As you said, it will be gradual.
Yeah, it will be gradual. What fraction of mass is left at the end?
No, we can't compute that explicitly. We can only do sort of these hand-waving calculations because that would require processing this region that we don't know how to treat.
But by the time you have reached that region, you're saying that most of the mass is not evaporated?
A fraction has not evaporated. A fraction of order one, we don't know.
Order one, you mean... So if it's a solar mass black hole, you mean maybe 10% of it is still in there.
Something like that, yeah.
Order what?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So this is quite different from what happened with the back reaction calculations in CGHS, where...
Correct.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
More questions? Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Jorge again.